Tonight's Bible reading comes from the book of James, chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. And this can be found in the Bibles in the seats on page 1196 or on the inside of the white sheets that you received when you came in. James chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That man should not think he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. The brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position. But the one who is rich should take pride in his low position, because he will pass away like a wildflower. For the sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant. Its blossom falls and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he goes about his business. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. When tempted, no one should say, "God is tempting me." For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. My dear brothers, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, for man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. Therefore, get rid of all moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent, and humbly accept the word planted in you, which can save you. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like a man who looks at his face in a mirror and, after looking at himself, goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But the man who looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues to do this, not forgetting what he has heard but doing it, he will be blessed in what he does. If anyone considers himself religious and yet does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world.
Good evening, 7 o'clock. How are you? Doing all right? Very good. I'm not sure about you, but I have to say I'm enjoying the opportunity to spend time looking into this whole issue of justice. I think this whole area brings the smell of excitement to it, which is captured in a story that I heard a year or so ago. I've shared a couple of times, and I can't remember whether I've shared it with you, but I'll share it again. It's the story of a little girl who was shopping with her mum, and she asked for a Barbie torch, and mum bought it, and she's standing at the checkout with it on, and like this, you know, and then she looked up at her mum and said, "Can we go somewhere dark so I can see my torch work? So, see the difference when it gets dark." Ooh, you know, we do this sort of stuff too. In the darkness, thanks Chris, in the darkness, that's where light takes its effect. That's where light can have its most power. And when people get engaged in justice, other people get rescued, like a child gets rescued, brought into a loving community, and we see them heal and we see them beginning to grow into a man or a woman who will be forever grateful that the one who calls himself the father of the fatherless and the one who is on the side of the quartet of the vulnerable is their God. Or we hear stories that will warm our hearts of children being taken out of sex slavery or out of child slave labor. And they inspire us and they make us feel alive. But then you realize that if you're going to rescue sex workers here in Sydney, that will bring you face to face with biker gangs. Or if you want to protect a child from pedophiles, you'll have to stand up with bullies. And the smell of excitement starts to smell a little like fear. Gary Haugen, the president of International Justice Ministry, says this: sometimes the will of God is scary because he's asking us to choose between being brave and being safe in order to love those in need. The call to be brave is underscored in the New Testament. Amy just read to us James 1, and one of the verses, verse 27, says, "Religion that the God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress." That is the religion God honours, to look after widows and orphans in their distress. And that is amplified by the Spirit of God in the book of Proverbs, where Proverbs says in Proverbs 17 and verse 5, "He who mocks the poor shows contempt for their maker." He who mocks the poor shows contempt for their maker. The Message translation of that verse says, "Whoever mocks the poor insults the Creator." And that's because, in part, God has identified with the poor. Like, think about Jesus for a moment. His cot was a feeding trough. He ate with the lowest. He rode into Jerusalem on the back of a borrowed donkey. He had his last meal in a borrowed room. He was buried in a borrowed tomb. As he identified with the poor, he also became a victim of injustice. Jesus' arrest, his interrogation and trial were all filled with illegalities and miscarriages of justice. In a world filled with injustice, we serve a God who has subjected himself to it first. And on the last day, should anyone ask, "But when did we see you naked? When did we see you hungry? When did we see you a prisoner?" Jesus may well say, "On the cross I was naked. On the cross I was thirsty. And in the lead up to the cross, I was a victim of injustice. I was a prisoner." Tim Keller says, "Jesus, who deserved vindication, got condemnation so that we who deserve nothing but condemnation could get vindication." He goes on and says, "We are saved by one who owed us nothing but rejection. And it's the experience of that grace that leads us to act justly, love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God." This is even more so when we note that in the Old Testament, the quartet of the vulnerable, the orphans, the widows, the poor and the refugees, the aliens, is reduced, it seems to me, to a trio in the New Testament. The widows, the poor and the orphans, because we are aliens. We are refugees two times over. We were strangers to God because of our sin. But now that we are his children by grace, we are now aliens to this world. We are the fourth part of the quartet of the vulnerable. And so, the Psalms say to us in Psalm 41 and verse 1, "Blessed is he who has regard for the weak," or another translation, "Blessed is he who considers the poor." Consider here means constantly give ourselves to understanding the position and the plight of the needy. It means giving ourselves to sustained reflection and circumspection to the quartet of the vulnerable. It means to give ourselves to such an extent that we'll roll up our sleeves to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. It's a call to tear ourselves away from part of the DNA of our denomination here in Sydney. I was at a conference with other Sydney Anglican senior ministers a while back now. There was a speaker speaking who's done a great deal of research on the Sydney Anglican Church over the last year or so. And before he started to speak, he just looked around the room. There were 19 or 20 of us in the room. He looked around the room and said, "You know, I could put any one of a number of issues on the table right here, right now. And you would all enter into animated conversation and debate over any one of those issues. You would spend the whole afternoon debating those. And you would walk away from this room thinking that you had done a great afternoon's work." And then he said these words, "But you would have done stuff all for the sake of the kingdom." Our denomination is marked in part of its DNA for the love of arguments and debates, which really are at the same level as how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. We are to give ourselves to the consideration of the poor. Gary Haugen again says this, "Sometimes the will of God is scary because he's asking us to choose between a life that looks successful and a life that is actually significant." The last 3 weeks we've given ourselves to the scriptures at depth, looking at this whole issue of justice. We've looked at what is doing justice. Then in Deuteronomy 15 we've looked at the community of justice. And then last week, well, exactly who is my neighbour? Tonight we want to look at taking justice to the public arena. Now, friends, this is a little more complex than anything we've looked at thus far, but I want to say to you this, Christianity is no stranger to complexity. For the last 2,000 years, Christians have pursued with a passion the full biblical framework of theology to guide us as we reflect on how to interact with our world. We need to pause for a moment and take this complexity into account, or at least some of it, what we can do in the time allotted to me. Otherwise, if we don't take into account the complexities that are involved, we will fall into a hole that could completely undo your walk with Jesus. It's a hole that I have fallen into once or twice. You see, I have believed that if a church was to rise up and do all that Christ calls upon it to do, she will change the world. I've long held the belief that if you have the courage to hold to the right beliefs and the right values and you think biblically, then like William Wilberforce or William Booth, you will change the world. That is a very simplistic view of the world. It's an idealistic view of life. To be sure, we can have an influence on the world like William Wilberforce or like William Booth. But did they really change the world? Well, the answer is no. While Wilberforce managed to make slavery illegal in the British Empire, there are many, many, many more slaves in our world than there were in his time frame. And while William Booth influenced his time, domestic violence and drunkenness and gambling and greed and poverty continue to leer at the widow, the orphan, the poor and the refugee. Now this does not mean that Wilberforce or Booth failed. It just alerts us to the age in which we find ourselves. And so before we dive into justice, taking it to the public square, we need to reflect on two broad points, which is part of the complexity. Now, I know you're up to this because this is 7 p.m. So we're going to look at that. The first thing we want to look at is the overlap of the ages, and then we want to look at our particular context. Once we've, just to give you a map of out tonight's talk, once I've looked at those two with you, I then want to look at four ways that we can take justice to the public arena. Okay, so let's look at the two broad things first. The first one is what we call the overlap of the ages. And the overlap looks like this. Let me do this this way. So, this is history as it unfolds at the beginning and into the future. At the beginning, God creates everything, and everything is really good. In fact, when he creates human beings, he says, it is very good. But we also know that God had to send Jesus into our world at some point, and we also know that there is a time coming when Jesus will return, the second coming. That puts us into what is called the overlap of the ages. At some point when Jesus returns, human history as we know it will come to an end. The end of this age will take place. But when Jesus came and died on the cross, a new age began. We live here in the overlap of the ages. Does that make sense so far? Nod? Good. This is where we live. This will help us make sense of the world in which we live. So at the beginning, when God created everything, we find that we were God's people. Some of you would have heard this if you've done Introduction to the Bible. If you haven't done it, I want to encourage you to do it. God's people in God's place. Anyone know what the third one is? Under God's rule. In the Garden of Eden, everything was as God wanted it to be. But then Adam and Eve rebelled, and we were no longer God's people in God's place under God's rule. Throughout the Old Testament, we see God working and working and working to this point up here. And as he does that, he teaches us what it might look like to be God's people in God's place under God's rule. You've got a bit of an idea of that in Deuteronomy 15, a community of justice where no one would be in need. And momentarily throughout history, God's people did live in God's place under God's rule, momentarily. But it always fell apart. And that goes way back here to the fall. When Adam and Eve said, I don't want to live with you anymore, they committed the sin of idolatry. The fascinating to me, as I've been reading about justice and a few other things the last couple of months, that idolatry is the most mentioned sin in the scriptures, and it brings the most severe reaction from God. Because idolatry dethrones God and puts self in place. And God hates that with a vengeance, because we sell ourselves short whenever we get caught in idolatry. And when people are caught up in idolatry, there are monumental consequences. Creation now is under God's condemnation. But God doesn't give up. He sends Jesus to deal with our idolatry, our sin, and to introduce a new era, a new age. And when Jesus returns, this current age will come to an end. But right now, and when it comes to an end, we will once again be God's people in God's place under God's rule. In this overlap, though, this is where idolatry is still rampant. This is where sin and poverty and injustice are in all their ugliness continue. And it's also in this era that we see the evidence of the kingdom of God breaking out in our world. So as Don Carson writes in one of his books, sometimes disease can be knocked out. Sometimes sex traffic can be considerably reduced. Sometimes slavery can be abolished in a region. Sometimes more equitable laws can foster justice and reduce corruption. Of course, none of these good things is guaranteed to be enduring. None brings a consummated kingdom. Yet, in these and countless other ways, change is possible. More importantly, doing good in the city, doing good to all people, is part of our responsibility as God's redeemed people. Now, if we would keep in mind this kind of synopsis of complexity, if we would bear this in mind, then we will not be disillusioned, because we know this tension will not be resolved until Jesus returns. And when he returns, then there will be justice. Until then, it's just us. And so as we are to get on with seeking justice, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly. That is the first broad point. The second one is our particular context. Oops. I've drawn this before, and my drawings have not got any better. This is the earth. This is the equator. Oh, it's a bit low, but that's the equator. This is where we live. What are you laughing at? That's us. That's great. Oh, good. We live here, south of the equator. This is our context. I keep asking the question, why are we south of the equator at this time? When the two major continents either side are nowhere near as well off as we are, nowhere near as peaceful as we are, when the Pacific Rim of Fire, not volcanic activity, but social unrest all around us exists, but Australia is like it is. And why are we here in Castle Hill? Why? Well, we have a role to play. Our brothers and sisters in China cannot meet like this. I have met a woman a number of times. Her name is, I can't say her name, but I've met her a couple of times, and she lives in China. She is an Australian citizen, but Chinese born. If she is caught going to church, she will be deported from her land of birth back here, but not allowed to bring her children or her husband with her. It's worse in North Korea, which is now the worst land in the world to live if you're a Christian. It's not flash in South Sudan either, where over the last 20 years, which would be pretty much the sum total of the existence of most of you, in the course of your life, 2 million southern Sudanese have been slaughtered for naming the name of Jesus. That means every day of your life, 273 Christians have been killed in the southern Sudan every day, or one every 5 minutes for the sum total of your life. They are not in the same position we are to think about injustice, because they are the victims of injustice. We are the ones who have the window right here, right now, that is open for us. We are the ones who have the relative freedom to express the mind of God, and with the education and the political nous that we have and the finances given to us, we are the ones to seek justice for those who cannot. And all the more reason for us to get on with acting justly, loving mercy, and walking humbly before our God. And this kind of puts a challenge before us in the West here in Castle Hill, particularly with the West's highly developed art of individual whining. It's not fair. He's got an iPhone 4 and I've only got an Android. It's not fair. She gets to go to London. I can only go to Parramatta. It's not fair. You can't tell me I failed an exam at school. I am special. The it's not fair kind of thing looks really lame when you realize that for the time that I've been speaking, 4 Sudanese Christians have been slaughtered for naming the name of Jesus. Or another child in a private school in this country has been exploited over the net by yet another adult. Who is crying out, it's not fair on their behalf? So Psalm 41 verse 1 says, we need to give ourselves to the consideration of the plight of the poor. We need to give ourselves to seeking justice in the public square, the arena outside this building and off this site. But the overlap of the ages, the theology that explains it, and our particular position need to constantly be in our minds as we look at this. So, with some of the complexity mapped out, I want to look at 4 levels that we can engage in to pursue justice. The first one is this: relief. James 1:27 says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after the orphans and the widows in their distress. We are to provide relief for the quartet of the vulnerable. We are to provide relief. We can do this in at least 3 ways. One, with our time. It might be as simple as joining the ARV team that visits the ARV village once a month and just spends time with people who are shut in. It may mean that you visit a special needs family and befriend someone with special needs. Just your time. Or your talents. You might take a leaf out of Dorcas' book in Acts chapter 9, who made clothes for the poor. It might be a little bit more involved than that. You might want to go to the Baulkham Hills Shire Council or Hornsby Shire Council and ask questions like this. What are the needs in our shire? Where are people doing poorly in our... How can we help? Just sit and talk with someone at council and find out how we can get engaged. If you have legal training, you might offer your service to Legal Aid or to Anglicare, or even seeking employment with a group like International Justice Ministry or Anglicare to work for the freedom of slaves. You might want to use your treasures, so time, talents and treasures. You could use your treasures. You could sponsor a high school or a university student by Compassion's Leadership Development Program. Do you know that for less than $4,000 a year, you can educate an undergraduate at a university who will one day take their place in their country and work to bring relief in their country? You can help raise up effective leaders who know and understand their culture and so make a difference. And over a lifetime, you could sponsor who knows how many LDP, Leadership Development Program students. Maybe some of you are earning wild amounts of money. Or one day, because of your education, you will earn lots of money. And so, I want to challenge you. Write a check that scares you. Fill in a credit card slip and put an amount down that makes your heart stop. Find a justice ministry that captures your heart and invest in it. There's a couple that come to the 10 o'clock service. They're involved in what's called the Fistula Foundation in Ethiopia. I'm not going to explain that in detail because I would throw up. But this ministry ministers to women in Ethiopia who are literally torn on the inside because of stillbirth. And the hospital repairs their bodies. But they need money. Write a check for an insane amount of money that causes your heart to stop. Don't be like a man I met once who is worth tens of millions of dollars. He has a black Amex card. Now, it sort of like goes, you know, ordinary, silver, gold, platinum, black. It's nosebleed territory. This is the card for the mega rich of the world. I met a guy with one of these. He wanted to give money to a church that I'd been speaking about, and so he invited me into his office, and I thought, this will be good. He wrote a check for $5,000. That's like me giving you 5 cents. He should have wrote a check for $500,000, because that would have made his heart stop a little. Maybe you have a heart for families with special needs children. If so, write a scary check for the next 3 years, $80,000 a year, so that we can employ a special needs children's worker to work amongst our community, so we can provide relief. The second thing is to relocate. It may be the Lord is calling you to relocate to another suburb of Sydney. I'm not thinking here of St. Ives. I'm not thinking here of Bondi. I'm thinking here of Redfern or Liverpool South. Be a missionary in our city, but live in a different area like two or three couples have done from this church over the years and are now working with the Anglican Church at Redfern. There they are being salt and light to that community. Maybe God will call you away from here to go to a place like that. Maybe you will be like Mark Gornick and his friend Alan Tibbles, who went to a depressed inner city suburb of Baltimore to live with people and to share their life, to learn to love them and their culture, their habits and the people and their children. You might want to read about it in their book called To Live in Peace. It's a fascinating read. If you go, my very great plea and encouragement is this: physically relocate, move house, for 10 years or more. Otherwise, It's a complete waste of time. When I was in the southwest in St. John's Park, we were there for 10 and a half, 11 years. I watched a church further south from us down the road see some families come from the North Shore. They would travel every weekend from the North Shore to this place thinking they were doing a good work. They did it every weekend for 2 years. And then when the minister retired, they all went back to the North Shore. And the church was worse off than when they started. It was a complete waste of time. If God is calling you to relocate, then go and live there for 10 years or more, so that you can make a difference to the oppressed and the poor. Third area is to redevelop. Listen to what God says to us in Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 13 and 14. 13 and 15, rather. Deuteronomy 15, verses 13 to 15. This is about the release of slaves. And when you release a slave, do not send him away empty-handed. No, supply him liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, and your winepress. Supply him liberally. Give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you. That is why I give you this command today. So, it's a call to ensure that the weakest and the poorest in our community get access to opportunities that they need in order to provide for themselves and their families. So in our world, it means at least things like give them access to an education, legal assistance, trading opportunities. Now, of course, there are some in our world that rort the systems, but the poor on the whole are not after charity or leftovers. It's much better for us to think in terms of what a Ugandan businessman I heard say a couple of years ago. He said, "We don't want charity. We want the opportunity to trade our way out of poverty. We want to trade on a level playing field." You might want to take up Max Collison's current project of trying to work out how to so make soap that anybody on the planet can make it and make a living out of it. Last time I talked to Max, he hadn't quite perfected the soap recipe and he hasn't worked out how to market it. He needs help. Maybe you could help in that way. Maybe you are a business person who would love to trade with Africans. If so, sign up for the next trip to Nairobi and get alongside business people in Kenya who are very sharp and learn from them how to help people in their country trade their way out of debt. Maybe you could go and help a micro business develop in the Kibera, for the Kibera tent slum, sorry, the Kibera slum dwellers who are tent makers. That is, these are pastors, these are young men who live in the slums. They're born in the slums, live in the slums, and do church work in the slums. Maybe you could get alongside them and help them. If you want to dip your toe in the water of this sort of thing, go to kiva.com and have a look at what they offer. For $25, you could help someone trade their way out of debt somewhere on the planet without leaving your lounge room. Fourth thing to do is to restructure. Injustice is not simply a micro thing. Systems work against the quartet of the vulnerable. You see, we in the West love our chocolate, and in Australia we particularly love our mobile technology and our sport. And so the consumer society and the systems which we live in provide us with all of these things, while child labour is used to produce cocoa for our chocolate addiction. Child labour is used to mine a rare earth mineral to supply the fast uptake of technology that we use in our pockets and our laps. And child slavery is used to sow soccer balls for the largest sport in our country. We need to be more like Job, who tells us in Job 29, verse 17. Job 29, verse 17. "I broke the fangs of the wicked and snatched victims from their teeth." Or maybe we need to be a little more like Daniel, who, though he was a prisoner in exile, was called before Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, judgment was coming. Daniel says to King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4 and verse 27, "O king, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be then your prosperity will continue." As I read around these things, it also seems to me that the way to go is not to go alone, but to develop networks. Martin Luther, the great reformer of the 1500s, was surrounded by a network of reformers. It wasn't he alone who brought Reformation to Germany and Europe. It was he and others like Gregory of Rimini or Joseph or whatever his name was, von Staupitz or Philip Melanchthon. They together rebuilt the German university and invented an academy to be the heart of social and ethical revolution in Europe. And William Wilberforce, he wasn't the only one. He was part of a group called the Clapham Sect. There was Hannah More, who used her cultural capital. There was Henry Thornton, his financial muscle as a merchant banker was used. Granville Sharp and Zachary Macaulay used their intellectual capital and extensive social networks, and together they brought legislation to pass in British Parliament. If you have a heart for working on the structures, then begin to develop networks with like-minded people. Find a network that includes an accountant, an entrepreneur, a media person, a lawyer, a business person, a researcher, someone in the arts and the music, wealthy men and women with connections. Develop networks. It seems as networks develop, you get the opportunity to work on a nation. And who knows, maybe 2 Chronicles 16:4 may come into place. God searches, God's eyes roam across the land, looking for those whose hearts are fully devoted to him, so that he might strengthen them. We must do all of this not because, we do all of this because our God calls us to do it. It's the right thing to do. God has had mercy on us, and so we must have mercy on others. And as we go, we must not lose sight of the message of salvation. You see, it's no good liberating the poor from the cycle of poverty if they do not know the Jesus who for their sakes became poor so that they might become rich. It is no good liberating men and women and children from sex slavery if they do not ever know the one who came to liberate them from the slavery to sin. You see, we're not trying to produce heaven on earth. We're not trying to produce a utopia. We're not in a Miss Universe pageant, you know. What is it that you want to do? I want to have a world with good values and world peace. That's not what we're trying to do. Those are good things. But the scriptures remind us that the reality of world peace will not take place until Jesus returns. And we now live in the overlap of the ages. And so justice and peace and so on are secondary things. The prime good is God himself, and the primary task of a man or a woman is to worship him. And next week, we're going to look at what that looks like as we look at justice, as we look at peace, beauty, and justice. Let me see if there are any questions. Can you share with us the book articles you've read to prepare for this series? Yes, there are a number. The first book was Tim Keller's book, Generous Justice. Then there was that book by Mark Gornick, Peace in the City. Don Carson's Christ and Culture Revisited. Only read that if you have a box of Panadeine Fort. It's a great book, but my goodness, you have to work hard at that. There's another book called Changing the World or something. Changing the World by... I'll have to find that. I can bring them next week. What else have I read? That'll do to start with. Keller, Generous Justice... Gornick, Peace in the City. Sorry? Carson's book is called Christ and Culture Revisited. But it really is a stiff read. Carson used words I didn't think you could like, I don't think they exist except in that book. There you go. Okay. Is St. Paul's excluded from the call to write a check that scares us? St. Paul's is a very rich church. You know, that question has another question behind it, which you may not be aware of, and that is, what place does a local church have in this area of ministry? It's another part of the complexity. The reason that a church, this is very technical, a reason why a church exists in the New Testament is to gather around Jesus and worship him. The church is a gathered community. It only exists as it gathers. So when we disband tonight, the church at 7 o'clock no longer exists. The people of God who come to church exist, but not the church. That's one part of the complexity. Secondly, we do give quite a bit. Last year, you know, I think I made this point painfully clear, but let me make it again clear. You know, we're often challenged that we don't give 10% of our money away, and that's right, we don't. Last year, we gave away over 22% of our money. We gave away over $300,000. How much money do you want us to give away? If you want us to give more, my question to you is, are you tithing? Are you tithing 10% of your pre-tax income? So I sit down and work it out that we're about $1.5 million to $2 million short on offertory every year. If you want us to give away more money, put more on the plate. Because we have ministry to do here, and we are doing ministry there. Over $300,000 left our coffers last year. Very exciting, isn't it? Very exciting. Could we give more? Yes. If we had more, we would give more. But over 22% of our money went away from us last year. Okay. Good, eh? If you want to talk about any of those a little more, then please catch me later, but that'll do us. I think we've had it's pretty heavy. I warned you that it was complex, yes? Justice is complex. I've said a number of times over the last few years that Christians have lost the ability to think. Tonight we've got an introduction to thinking as we should.